It is 8:32, and we have with us live in the studios once again, Joff Parrish and Maria Tomchick, both with Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
Let's dive right in with a local news this week, starting out with fraud at the port.
Yes.
Shock. I'm shocked, I tell you.
Who would have known this was going on? Well, state auditors knew it was going on. They released their audit last December saying that they had detected what they suspected was fraud in the construction of the third runway. And, of course, everyone was shocked and said, oh, no, can't be in the port. Step forward and, you know...
Well, everyone at the port said that.
Yeah, everybody at the port said that, and the head of the port at the time stepped forward and said, oh, well, we will start our own internal investigation and try to detect what actually happened. And so they started their own investigation, and lo and behold, a year later, those investigators have released their report, and guess what? They found fraud at the port's management of the construction for the third runway. Well, some of the stuff that they cited is just egregious. Things like, and it echoes exactly what the state audit said, that the port broke up large contracts into smaller pieces to avoid the competitive bidding process, that they added work to a $25,000 emergency non-competitive contract until it was a $1 million project and should have been put out for bid. They added things on that weren't part of the scope of the original project, etc. That they favored certain contractors over others, and one of the contractors, TTI Construction, which is a partnership of Gary Merlino Construction, Scarsella Brothers, and Tri-State Construction, that company in particular lied to the port in the in a contract involving the construction of the embankment for the third runway. They told the port that they were losing money when, in fact, they were actually making a 15% profit. And in telling the port they were losing money, the port upped their contract so that, in the end, TTI made a 30% profit. It turns out that Mick Dinsmore, the head of the port at the time, negotiated the embankment contract with TTI. That's the famous negotiation over the steak dinner and drinks. And that another port employee later lied about a cost reduction to avoid scrutiny of the embankment contract. So it wasn't just Dinsmore, it was other members of the port who favored TTI Construction and basically engaged in collusion to route as much taxpayer money in their direction as possible.
Yeah, and let's not forget the oversight from that relentless watchdog of corruption and waste, Pat Davis.
Yeah, the port commission rarely stepped in to look at the books, and even when it would have been, you would think it would have been obvious that some of these contracts and some of the work that was going on should have port commission oversight. Well, the port commissioners were essentially asleep at the wheel. But
I don't think they were asleep. I think they knew exactly what was going on and were colluding in it. But that wasn't part of the scope of the internal investigation.
That wasn't part of the investigation. The investigation also uncovered that port staff even awarded contracts to their favorite construction companies for work that had already been completed. So that is outright fraud. And one employee, a former Port of Seattle Aviation Division Director, Gina Marie Lindsay, she left the port in 2004 to work for a company called McBee Strategic Consulting. That's a lobbying firm, which then got a contract for almost $1 million over several years in a no-bid contract with the port. So that tells you what's going on. Essentially, employees at the port were favoring contractors so that they could, when they leave office, they could go and work for those companies. So pretty egregious. And now the U.S. Department of Justice is looking at this and saying, well, okay, we're expanding our fraud investigation to include Dinsmore's golden parachute, and I guess they're grilling Pat Davis about that right now and about her role in that whole scandal. So I also wanted to point out, too, that Pat Davis, who's at the focus of that part of the Department of Justice's investigation, she had the temerity a couple weeks ago to propose an 11% tax increase for Washington taxpayers to support the Port of Seattle, even when the Port of Seattle can't spend all the money they're currently collecting now. And it just made me wonder, when I heard that, it made me wonder, where the heck is Tim Iman when you really need him, you know? But fortunately...
Having lunch with Pat Davis, why do you ask?
All right. So fortunately, four of the port commissioners voted down that tax increase this week. Bill Bryant, John Crichton, Lloyd Hara, and Gail Tarleton.
In other words, all of them except Pat
Davis.
Except
Pat Davis, yeah.
So that tax increase would have been for King County, right? Not
would
Washington.
Yes, sorry. Okay. Would have been for King County.
All right. Moving on.
The Port of Seattle actually has a taxing authority for all of King County. It's not strictly a City of Seattle entity.
Yeah.
Moving on to the Seattle School District, and looks like they're going to be closing some schools.
Yes, the latest round of proposed school closures. This is the third time in 4 years that the school district has tried to close schools, and there has been a firestorm of fairly justified criticism each time, not because the district doesn't need to close schools. Enrollment is down fairly sharply from its peak in past decades, and the school district is facing up to a $40 million shortfall and is looking for ways to save money. But the way they have gone about closing schools has been very troubling, and the schools that are singled out for closure and for moving and consolidation in past proposals have been troubling at all. Last time around, 2 years ago, when the district closed, I believe the final tally was 7 schools from the 9 originally proposed. The overwhelming majority of the schools involved were south of the Ship Canal. And lo and behold, this time, almost all of the schools involved are either heavily non-white schools or they are alternative schools of one sort or another. The new school superintendent, Maria Goodloe Johnson, proposed an amendment to the closure plan this week that would have involved closure of 2 more schools, the K-12 Summit Alternative School and Rainier Beach High School, which is the smallest of the Seattle School District high schools, but it is also one of the cultural hearts of the African American community in many ways. Once again provoking a whole firestorm of criticism. But one of the interesting things about this dynamic that really hasn't been pointed up in local media coverage of the closure plans is how intimately tied in it is to No Child Left Behind and to the WASL test, because those standardized tests have a financial impact on the school district vis-a-vis the performance of the schools. So what you wind up having targeted as being the quote-unquote non-performing schools are those schools where the children don't do as well as standardized tests, namely schools where kids are disadvantaged economically or from less advantageous homes because the parents don't raise as much money through the PTSAs to help support the schools.
And provide extra tutors and things
like that. Yeah, the one of the dirty little secrets of the Seattle School District is that there's a vast funding discrepancy between the more the wealthier schools in the north end and the more impoverished schools in minority communities, not because there's the funding mechanism of the school district itself is unfair, it's actually fairly equitable, but because on top of that, essentials for the schoolroom are being supplied by fundraising that's done outside the school district by parents and supporters of the schools. So you have this funding inequity, you have cultural problems and problems in the home that lead to problems with test scores, and you have alternative schools which tend to attract kids who learn in different ways. They don't do as well on standardized tests. They might be more artistic, they might be kinesthetic learners, etc., etc. And this type of learning and these types of kids are essentially being punished by the standardized testing paradigm. And now we see the school district and the schools in Seattle singling out those schools for moving or closure because they're underperforming. And it's a very troubling sort of spiral that you see where these are the schools that are being picked on and these are the kids that are being driven out of the school district essentially because they don't perform well on test scores. In the case of alternative schools, the parents might wind up sending them to private schools. In the case of the more impoverished schools, a lot of those kids will just drop out. And that unfortunately does not serve the public as well, but it does serve the bottom line of the school district.
All right. Go from that to the Seattle City Council having a vote this week on streetcars.
Yeah, the City Council Transportation Committee voted 4-2 to approve a streetcar system for Seattle in spite of budgetary problems and cutbacks because of the economy. And now that vote's going to go to the main council for a final vote on Monday. Just to remind people, there's $600 million on the line to basically duplicate bus routes, and only the streetcar system is going to move people around much more slowly, even though it might seem a little more attractive to city planners and businesses. Richard McIver and Nick Licata were the two no votes on the Transportation Committee. And Licata raised the main issues. He said there's no clear plan on where the money is going to come from. That $600 million to build the system is going to come from. It duplicates bus routes, particularly to the university district. How are we going to maintain and run it? It's not like it's going to be a cheap system to maintain and run. And rider fares are not going to cover the cost.
Yeah, and this also. Once again, underscores the haphazard way that Seattle does its transportation planning, mm-hmm. where there's once again a technology that there is a constituency for that's in love with, and so they ram through a plan without having thought it through and without coordinating with other types of transportation plans, whether it's expanded bus coverage or it's light rail.
Or the Mercer.
We saw this with the monorail. Yes. Mm-hmm. We're seeing this with the Mercer MES proposal, and we're seeing it now with the streetcars. And it's a really bad way to do transportation planning.
Yeah, it's essentially another part of the city beautification project that includes
Allen City Beautification Project.
That includes changes in South Lake Union and including the Mercer MES and now the streetcar system.
All right. Well, speaking of city beautification projects, some work out this week on the viaduct?
Yeah. The study by a consultant, ECO Northwest.
The tearing it down is part of the beautification project? Is that the idea?
Yeah. Well, the tearing it down and putting it in a tunnel, if you're a member of the downtown business community, would beautify the city considerably. For the rest of us, especially those people who drive the viaduct, they find it's rather a beautiful experience. But a consultant this week hired to look at the economic cost of various viaduct replacement options said that there appears to be little change in the drive time for I-5 drivers, regardless of what option is built. And what I thought was very interesting is that the study said there would be a very small impact on the regional economy from any of the 8 options, and that there was relatively small differences in travel time between all of those 8 options. And that's because I think the only option that would have increased capacity slightly, which would have been the 6-lane tunnel, is completely off the table because it came in, when they penciled it out, it came in near to be almost, I think, $11 or $12 billion to build the 6-lane tunnel. So that's completely off the table. And I think what's also interesting is that the study found that the greatest increase in waterfront property values, of course, comes with the tunnel options, which is why the downtown business community really supports the tunnel options, and why even after a public vote that said, no, we don't want a tunnel downtown, yeah, is still on the table, that the option that would have resulted in the least increase in waterfront property values is, of course, the elevated highway replacement option, so putting in a new elevated highway, that's no surprise. And that in the mid-range is the surface boulevard, which is what I'm pushing for and what I think other people ought to push for. And I just want to remind folks that in the next week or so, Governor Gregoire, Mayor Greg Nichols, and County Executive Ron Sims are going to get together and try to figure out what the final option is going to be. And if folks want to weigh in on this, they should focus their input on Governor Gregoire, because after all, she's the person who is holding the purse strings. So.
All right. Well, finally, on locals, speaking of waterfront, the people of Maury Island are looking at a new gravel pit.
Yeah, it's not new. It exists already, the gravel and sand mine on Maury Island. But there's been a proposal that's been on the table actually for several years now to expand that mine some 200-fold, put in a new pier, and basically turn it into a major industrial facility right next to a supposedly protected marine preserve. And this has been a huge environmental issue on Maury Island for some time. Well, Doug Sutherland, the Republican who was just voted out as Commissioner of Public Lands, as a lame duck, very quietly this week approved that 200-fold expansion of the mine on Maury Island, and he did so Even though it threatens several species covered by the Environmental Species, the Endangered Species Act, which of course Republicans would just as soon ignore. So environmentalists are filing suit over that. But the other sort of interesting sleazy part of this is that the owner of the mine, the company that owns the mine, gave $50,000 to a so-called independent group that campaigned for Sutherland during his recent election campaign against Peter Goldmark. Now, Goldmark is coming in as the new commissioner of public lands. He opposes the expansion on Maury Island, but it's unclear that he can do anything at this point to stop this. So it's winding up in the courts.
All right. Then that takes us over to national and this week's economic news.
Okay, I just want to talk about the numbers. The most surprising number this week was the National Bureau of Economic Research, a nonprofit organization whose job is to keep track of the economic cycles and announce when expansions have begun and when they end, and of course when recessions and depressions begin and when they end, announced this week that the U.S. officially entered the recession in December. December of 2007. So it's been a whole year that we've been in a recession. And I think it's interesting because the NBER doesn't just look at gross domestic product. It looks at a broader range of indicators, including unemployment and the impact of economic downturns on the population.
Now, the obvious question is, if this actually happened in December of last year and none of the indicators that they were using to make this pronouncement are new, why did that announcement not come until... wait a minute, was it 3 weeks after the election?
Correct.
Did that possibly have been related?
Right. Well, yeah. No, they don't. They're a private organization. They're nonprofit, so they're not connected to the U.S. federal government in any way. But they're academics, and of course, many of them, I'm sure, are looking at jobs in an upcoming administration. I mean, these are the ranks of people from which President Obama and future presidents would draw, you know, Treasury Secretary and economic advisors into their administration.
So it was being peer reviewed.
Yeah, right. So you know, and it takes a little time to decide when is the best moment to make these announcements. So anyway, and also this week there were a couple of other numbers I want to go over. Unemployment, the Labor Department said on Friday that 533,000 jobs, that's more than 500,000 jobs, were lost in November alone. And that's a huge spike in the unemployment rolls. Since December 2007, the beginning of the recession, the total jobs lost is almost 2 million, so 1.9 million people out of work. Newly out of work. Unemployment spiked to 6.7% and would have hit 7%, official unemployment that is, if 422,000 people hadn't simply dropped off the unemployment rolls. People drop off the unemployment rolls for a number of reasons: when their unemployment benefits expire, when they stop looking for work, when they go back to school. There are all kinds of reasons. But to see almost 500,000 people completely disappear off the radar, that's a little spooky. And I just want to, for comparison, remind people that during the Great Depression, about one quarter of the population was out of work. We're at 7%, so things are not that bad yet.
see, the fundamentals of the economy really are strong.
Well, I don't know. You could talk to the 1 in 10 U.S. homeowners with a mortgage who were either behind on their house payments or in foreclosure in September. That's before the stock market took its historic dive in October. So that number, 10% of U.S. homeowners with a mortgage being behind on their payments or in foreclosure, that number is probably going to be higher when they look at the October statistics. Also this week, Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke finally woke up and recognized that there was a housing crisis. He called on the government to do something to help homeowners, particularly those folks who are going through foreclosure. In kind of a forehead smacker, he said, quote, "Steps that stabilize the housing market will help stabilize the economy as well." No kidding.
Shouldn't that have come like a year ago?
A couple years ago, I think, actually. He made a couple suggestions. He actually came out in support of the FDIC chairman Sheila Bair's plan, which she has actually put into place at the banks that the FDIC has taken over. Her plan, again, is to allow homeowners to write down the value of their mortgage to match the market value of their homes, and then take the loss that the bank would have to eat. the FDIC then reimburses the bank for half that loss. So the bank does take a write-down, but they then have an incentive in recouping half their loss to negotiate with homeowners instead of simply kicking them out and reselling the house. So that plan's been already put into place, but it's put into place unilaterally by the FDIC with homeowners who have mortgages through IndyMac and other banks that the FDIC has taken over. And Bernanke also suggested that the government should buy mortgages and refinance them. That's sort of taking the troubled asset relief program, that $700 billion, and saying instead of it's actually looking at the TARP's original mandates. Instead of buying mortgage-backed securities from banks, let's buy mortgages.
Yeah, what is TARP? What is TARP, by the way? People don't know.
It's the Troubled Asset Relief Program. It's a $700 billion bailout program. It's not actually being used to buy troubled assets. Its original mandate is being used to recapitalize banks right now. So what Bernanke is saying, you should take some of that money and actually buy, do what TARP was originally designed for, which is buy up mortgages and refinance them. Well, Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson has resisted that. He thinks that those are both bad ideas. He says that Baer's plan won't work, even though it's actually working right now in real time at this moment. He doesn't want to expand it to the whole housing market. And the Bush administration has dug in their heels and said that they will not bail out little people. They will not buy and refinance mortgages.
That's, in order to bail out little people, you would have to acknowledge that they exist.
Yeah, that's true. So instead, he's proposed that Fannie and Freddie buy mortgage-backed securities, doesn't this sound familiar, to drive down interest rates to 4.5% for people who are new homeowners who want to buy houses. That's just going to make things worse. For one thing, there's no guarantee that banks will use the cash for new loans. And secondly, it's just trying to turn back the clock to 2005 and 2006 and just drive interest rates down and heat up the housing market again. It just drives us deeper into trouble. So I just wanted to very quickly talk about the automakers bailout. That's kind of being negotiated. You'll read about it a little bit more this next week. What concerns me is that I talked to a friend this week who works in China. He's a businessman who spends about half the year traveling to China. He says that the hottest selling car right now is a hybrid. Hottest selling car in China right now is a hybrid produced by Chrysler. Chrysler is very popular in China. It makes a huge profit there. He said that when he rode in this hybrid car that one of his suppliers owns in China, when he rode in this car, he said you could take a Toyota sticker, put it on that car, and you wouldn't know the difference. Rides just like a Toyota hybrid. So Chrysler really has no excuse for not building those kind of cars here in the U.S. So what I would say is to Senator Harry Reid and Representative Nancy Pelosi, demand that these automakers open their books and demand that they get off the stick and start doing something instead of simply asking for a cash handout.
Yeah, you were saying Chrysler's a private company,
so legally they don't have to open their books unless, of course, you hold out the carrot, open your books, or we won't give you the money.
Well, that takes us over then to international, and starting with Mumbai.
Yeah, a lot going on this week, and we don't have a whole lot of time to get into it, but Condoleezza Rice went to sort out the problems between India and Pakistan this week. Pause for the laugh track. It looks like the plot leaders for the attacks in Mumbai over the last couple of weeks came from Pakistan, but were part of a radical Islamist group that has some connections to the ISI, the Pakistani intelligence service, and figures in there. And tensions are very high right now between Pakistan and India. The Times of India reporting also that the Taliban was issuing a threat to take over Pakistan and the city of Peshawar in the northwest frontier province, quote, very soon. A car bomb killed 29 people and wounded 90 in Peshawar yesterday. So there's a lot of chaos chaos going on and a lot of tension between basically four players: the Islamists, which is to say Al-Qaeda and the Taliban and their sympathizers, the Pakistani government, the United States government, and the Indian government. How that's going to shake out is up to question, but it's very clear that the Bush administration and Condoleezza Rice have very little leverage in the situation right now, other than, you know, their ability to bomb, which doesn't please anybody. A group affiliated with Al-Qaeda also was confirmed to have killed 16 policemen that it kidnapped in Iran. That was announced this week, emphasizing once again that Iran actually is pitted against the Islamists in the war on terror, so that when you hear President Bush or other Republicans coming out and saying, well, the Iranians, they support terror, yada, 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 they're actually fighting the same people the United States is fighting in this particular conflict, but you would never know it from Washington's policy right now. And then we also had a number of killings in Iraq this week. A car bomb that went off yesterday, for example, in Fallujah, killing a number of people. So there's a lot of different things going on that front right now, and it's a very unstable situation, and it's going to be a real mess for the incoming Obama administration.
And how about events this week?
A couple of them I wanted to plug. Both on Tuesday the 9th and on Thursday the 11th, there will be benefits for a Nova High School trip to New Orleans. Nova, of course, one of the schools that is high schools, alternative schools that is being singled out in the school closure plan. They're going to be relocated, presumably. Anyway, some of their students are going to a trip to New Orleans, and to raise money for that, Malik Rahim, who is the co-founder of Common Ground, the New Orleans Relief Project that's done a lot of amazing work over the past several years, he is going to be in Seattle Tuesday, 5 to 7 p.m. at the Benham Art Gallery, 1216 First Avenue, and then Thursday, 7 p.m. at New Hope Baptist Church, on 21st, a block north of Yesler. And then also, two of our favorite groups, Community Alliance for Global Justice and Reclaim the Media, are having a holiday party in the theme of Carolers United to Stop Shopping. That information will be posted. It wasn't up last night, but it should be posted very soon, I hope, for a party next Friday at reclaimthemedia.org.
All right, and also Community Alliance for Global Justice is the sponsor of today's teach-in happening all day at Seattle Central Community College.
Yes, and that's already started. It starts at 9 o'clock.
Confronting the Food Crisis, Cultivating Just Alternatives to the Corporate Food System. So Seattle Central Community College in the Science and Math Building, which is just north of the main building. All right, talking as we do every week with John Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
Eat the State comes out every couple of weeks with local, global news, opinion, humor, etc. You can find it where you find free publications or on the web at www.eatthestate.org. And if you have questions, comments, tips, would like to get a hold of one of our BAFO t-shirts or do a gift subscription or anything that would help us pay the bills, we'd appreciate it. It's a nonprofit volunteer labor of love. So any support you can provide is always appreciated. You can get a hold of us at info@eatthestate.org.